Today, I should like to speak about the role of womanhood in this great church.
In 1973, a man named N. Eldon Tanner gave a talk in the LDS Church's twice yearly general conference. Tanner was in the faith's governing first presidency, and the title of the address was No Greater Honor, the Woman's Role.
From the beginning, God made it clear that woman is very special and has also very clearly defined her position, her duties, her destiny.
At this moment in time, the Equal Rights Amendment was well on its way to becoming official, a part of the Constitution, which, when it was drafted, had left women out of the guarantee for equal protection. The ERA had already been passed by Congress the year before, and the next step was getting the states to ratify it. And most figured this was just a technicality, was picking up momentum. LDS church officials hadn't come out and said anything at this point, but they were worried women were being pulled away from family life.
We must never forget that one of a woman's greatest privileges, blessings, and opportunities is to be a co-partner with God in bringing His Spirit children into the world. We hear so much about emancipation, independence, sexual liberation, birth control, abortion, and other insidious propaganda belittling the role of motherhood, all of which is Satan's way of destroying the woman, the home and the family, the basic unit of society.
Here's the thing. At this point, most Mormons were fine with the ERA. Members, lawmakers. The scholar Neil Young, who has studied this history, says the Utah legislature, just like legislatures in other states, was ready to pass the ERA.
There's a poll taken in Utah and 1974, I believe, that shows 61-62% of Utah residents are for it. Certainly a majority of the Mormon legislators in the Utah legislature are on record that they will be supporting the amendment. And all indications are that Utah is going to be the 35th state that ratifies the amendment when it takes it up in like 1974 and 1975.
Young says the day before the Utah legislature's opening session in 1975, the day before, the church makes its move. It publishes an editorial in the Deseret News.
The church finally releases a statement saying that it is opposed to the ERA and calls this a moral issue. This is the church's first foray into a national political issue. For them, it struck at the divinely ordained nature of men and women.
It is of great concern to all that Satan and his cohorts are using scientific arguments, nefarious propaganda, to lure women away from their primary responsibilities as wives, mothers, and homemakers.
Calling for equality of sexes was to undermine the God-created differences of men and women, and that in doing that, it was a threat to the family. The timing of it was incredibly important in terms of just like that kind of 1-2 punch. Overnight, public opinion shifts, and most importantly, those votes in the Utah legislature go in a different direction, and it's roundly defeated when the Utah legislature finally votes on the ERA.
Today in Radio West, we're talking about the Equal Rights Amendment, which needs just one more state to make it into the Constitution. And wouldn't that be interesting if that one state that pushes it over the line is Utah? Because you could argue it was Utah, or anyway, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Utah, that was instrumental in defeating the amendment in the 70s. We're going to begin with Neil Young. He's an independent scholar, and he told us two things were important about the LDS Church's campaign to kill the ERA. First, that it came to be a kind of strategic template for the church's opposition to other issues it would fight. The other part that was important was that members didn't just take the church's editorial as an opinion, but as the Word of God.
There's real changes happening in the LDS Church around theology. In the same time period, a little bit before, about the prophetic role, the prophetic nature of the president of the LDS Church. So particularly in the 60s and the early 70s, in the same kind of time period, the church is emphasizing much more than it had in the past that the current leader of the church, whoever that was, the president, was also a prophet.
Yeah.
In the past, particularly in the early 20th century, Mormons had thought that Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, that the prophets of the Old Testament, that those alone were the men with prophetic status. But in the 1950s, and increasingly so in the 1960s and the early 70s, the LDS Church is asserting that the present leader of the LDS Church has prophetic status. And so I think that that is incredibly important here, because what it does is it sets up the theological foundation upon mm-hmm. which one can make political claims that aren't about, you know, that aren't just a person's opinion, a person's political stance, but that is a message from God. And that was the church's claim in the ERA battle. Now, they never explicitly said that the church's opposition to the ERA was a direct message from God, but in some ways they didn't have to do so, because yeah. the theological understanding had been so firmly established by this point that that sort of specification was no longer required. So for a message to come out from the first presidency, to come out from the official voice of the church, was to essentially let Mormons know that this was a message from God, that this is God's position.
So the Equal Rights Amendment battle becomes a kind of testing ground for the political participation of LDS church leaders. So it's sort of, it becomes in some ways, is it fair to say, a template for political participation in other issues later?
Absolutely. What it learned, what the church learned in the ERA battle, and the kind of institutional approach that they take and the organizational approach, this ground game that they mobilize, that becomes the template, the blueprint for ongoing political action in the decades that follow. And we see that most clearly in the church's opposition to marriage equality. It's the exact same ground game. They actually use a lot of the same organizational structure in terms of, you know, activating the Relief Society, in using local organizations that are created by the church but kind of stand outside of the church. So in the anti-ERA battle, what the church did in different states where it was active was it created these ground, these grassroots organizations that on the outside appearance seem to have no connection with the LDS church. So almost all of them have names like Georgia Families Today or Virginia Concerned Citizens that didn't have any reference to the LDS church. And that was done intentionally. They wanted this to not look like it was being directed from Salt Lake City, but that it was a movement of citizens, of concerned citizens who were doing this on their own. But all of this was orchestrated from Salt Lake City. All of this was being directed through the church structure. And that same pattern of directing things from Salt Lake City through the church network, but giving it this external appearance of a citizen-led movement, that's what we see happening in the church's work against marriage equality.
This gets us to the story that you tell in 1977, in June of that year. And thousands of women are in Salt Lake City for this conference. And the, of course, the big talk is, as is going on nationally, the Equal Rights Amendment. And Utah's conference, this is kind of remarkable. Utah's conference is bigger than any of the other states. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about why. Because basically, the LDS Church was stacking the deck.
So these conferences, they were called IWY conferences. That stood for the International Women's Year. This was a UN-backed event that was happening really all over the world. And so different countries were having IWY conferences. There was a national IWY conference that's held in the U.S. In Houston. But most states had their own IWY conferences. And these were seen very much as like feminist conferences. And many of these state conferences were using their convenings to pass resolutions supporting the ERA. So mm-hmm. the idea was that we'll have this big event will pass a resolution saying that we are calling for it, we support the ERA. This will be a huge public signal of our state's support for this issue. And if our state hasn't yet ratified that, that'll be a good sign to the legislators there that they should do so. So as the event is about to happen in Utah, initially the church thinks, okay, we don't want to have anything to do with this. Our concern is that if we have any sort of role in this convening, it will be misinterpreted as a support for feminism. It'll be misinterpreted as a support for the ERA, because that's what it looks like in all these other states. But someone in church leadership realizes, actually, we can take this opportunity to change the conversation, essentially, to give a very different public image. If we flood this convention with LDS delegates, we are assured that we will have very different resolutions coming out of it, including a defeat of any sort of resolution about the ERA. Mm. And so that's what the church did. It mobilized thousands of LDS women to show up at this conference and to vote against the ERA resolution and to send this powerful public message that the ERA is not supported in Utah, and also to signal that women around the country aren't supportive of this amendment.
So wait, so their Mormon stake presidents and Mormon bishops are basically assigning women from these different congregations to go to this conference. And in some cases, although this is not entirely clear, they were given instructions of what to do, basically vote no on some of these ideas, particularly the ERA.
Yes. So it really varied across Utah. And there's some really interesting historical evidence here about sort of some of the inconsistencies in terms of what women were told to do and kind of the messages they received. In some wards, we know that women were told that this was a calling, that this was something that they were, had been called to do. And of course, that's a Mormon idea about their obligation to the church and to God in terms of fulfilling kind of spiritual responsibilities and church duties. So some women believed they had been called to attend this conference. And the general idea was that every ward, 10 women were to be selected from across the state, and that through those, each ward providing 10 women, it would be thousands and thousands who would show up. So again, in some wards, women were told this was a calling. In others, they were just kind of assigned to it. Either way, it doesn't seem to have changed the responsibility with which women attended this conference. And they were told to vote no in the ERA, against the ERA resolution. One of the kind of interesting things I found from some of the women who wrote about or spoke about their participation in this was that some women had been told so much that they were to vote no that every single resolution that came up was voted down. Okay. Even ones that if you'd taken a chance or taken a second to actually read it or listen to it, you realized it was actually maybe a conservative resolution. But there was such a kind of mindset that everything in this was a feminist resolution that they just voted no for every resolution that came up, with the goal of ultimately making sure that the resolution about ERA would be defeated.
So organizers of the conference are expecting something like 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. 14,000 women attend. And I think you say of that number, 13,000 were Mormon women.
Yeah, the ERA didn't stand a chance when those were the numbers that showed up. And so this got, first of all, a ton of publicity. I mean, the New York Times writes about this. It becomes this major national event because it's such a big conference. I mean, none of the other state conferences were seeing these sorts of numbers, but also because it was a signal of the LDS Church's mobilization around this issue. It was kind of the first real national understanding of what was going on.
You say that in the telling of the story of the Equal Rights Amendment, the role of the LDS Church has lately anyway been largely ignored. Explain what you mean and why do you figure?
Well, one of the interesting things, so I came across the ERA, the anti-ERA battle, my first year of graduate school. And one of the things that really struck me as I was reading different histories of the ERA movement and the anti-ERA efforts was that in almost every book, the LDS Church got literally one sentence. It would be, you know, and the LDS Church also played a role in defeating the amendment in certain Intermountain West states. And that just struck me because it seemed significant enough to merit mention. But again, that one sentence mention seemed to speak to a really unexplored story that potentially was much bigger than historians were saying. And so that was what initially drew me to this topic and made me want to investigate it more. And what I learned in researching was that the church and its role in defeating the ERA in the 1970s deserved far more than one sentence in the accounts of the anti-ERA movement, and that in fact its effect and its significance was felt in states far beyond Utah and Nevada, far beyond the places where we have historically understood the LDS Church to have its biggest political significance, that in fact it was conducting a campaign that was national and that was targeted, again, as I said, to certain states, but in all sorts of different regions. In Virginia, in Florida, in Tennessee, in Illinois, in Washington State, in Hawaii, some states of which we maybe are not all that surprised about the LDS Church's political activism, but in many states where I think we are. And that in understanding, again, that national movement orchestrated from Salt Lake City, we could understand, first of all, why the ERA was defeated in the 1970s, but also we could better understand the LDS Church's ongoing political involvement in national issues.
There's this really, I have to say, kind of ironic twist in this story that you write about, that the women who had gone to this conference and Mormon women in general who were against or found themselves fighting against the ERA were actually resisting themselves some of the limitations of Mormon theology to make them more subservient and submissive. That in some ways this was, again, ironically, a way of them asserting their own sense of power within Mormonism.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found really compelling about this as I investigated it and wrote about it was, you know, this is a time period in which the LDS Church is especially emphasizing the domestic responsibilities of women, of LDS women, that their primary obligation was the home, was their marriage, and was child rearing. Again, think about the larger context of the time where, you know, just years after the real the kind of upsurge of the women's movement, you have a culture that's shifting around questions of gender, of sexuality, at, you know, lightning speed in these years. And the church is, in that cultural and political context, it's really increasing its emphasis on women as primary caregivers, as someone whose only responsibility is to be in the home, as wives and mothers, and to resist the message of feminism about whatever that is, if that's professional fulfillment or loosening of sexual norms, et cetera. And so this is a period in which the church's messages about women is ongoing. It's constant. It's incredibly pointed. And it's also a time period in which the church is making internal changes in terms of its institutional structure. So the Relief Society, which had long been an independent organization or had a sort of kind of autonomy within the church, it's brought under the male leadership of the LDS Church. There's all sorts of ways that women are losing power within Mormonism in this time period, both theologically and organizationally. And so one of the things I really thought about was, well, what does it mean in this same time period in which women are being told over and over again that they are only supposed to be homemakers, that they are only supposed to be wives and mothers, in which they're actually losing institutional power within the church itself? What does it say that at that same moment that the church is designating them as its political actors in this fight against the ERA? Now, on one hand, it makes sense why the church is doing so. The best way to defeat what is seen as a women's equality, a women's movement issue is to mobilize women against it, right? That looks smart politically. But what does it mean for LDS women to have this opportunity for public influence and really public life at the very moment in which they're being told that the domestic life is their highest calling, and in fact, their only calling? And so one of the things I found that was so interesting was that, and I think it was at the heart of women's interest in becoming so active in this, was that it gave them an opportunity to kind of assert themselves, but to do so in ways that were acceptable within Mormonism.
Yeah.
That actually this was a way of showing how devout you were and how much you conformed to Mormonism's idea about what women were to do and what women were to be, but one in which allowed you a lot of public life and a lot of influence and power.
Let me ask you, let's mention one more thing, finally, and not to put too fine a point on it, but I wanted to talk about the final vote taken at the International Women's Year Conference in Salt Lake City. The resolution. Here's the resolution. Let me read it. The Equal Rights Amendment should be ratified. What's the vote?
It's overwhelmingly defeated. I mean, and it's a landslide.
8,956 against, 666 for.
There you have it, right? And I mean, that is a not surprising defeat in terms of, again, who showed up at this conference. But in terms of its public, its national implications, it's an overwhelming defeat. I mean, again, think about this is a amendment that has for many years seemed uncontroversial. So many states are ratifying it. And here is a vote that is a complete decimation of the resolution that calling for it to be passed, and that it's being done again by women. So it was so important for conservative activists and conservative organizers who were fighting the ERA to show that women didn't want the ERA and that women were actually often more opposed to it than men were. It was so important to get that message out and to, you know, change people's minds about who would be for this and who might be against this. And Mormon women are central players in that.
Dr. Young, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Neil J. Young. He's an independent scholar. His latest book is We Gather Together, The Religious Right and the Problem of Interfaith Politics. When we come back from a break, the attorney Kate Kelly will join us to talk about why the ERA still matters today. This is Radio West.
Hey, it's Lee Hale. You know how they say there are certain things you just shouldn't bring up in mixed company? Well, this week on the Preach podcast, we're breaking all the rules.
Sex and God, those are like huge things to be thinking about.
That's Dr. Batsheva Marcus, a feminist Orthodox Jewish sex therapist. We talk about how studying the Talmud led to a study of human sexuality. That's on the Preach podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Equal Rights Amendment, which faded from the national conversation after it was defeated in the 1970s. As we've been talking about, the LDS Church played an important role in that. Now, today, the ERA needs just one more state to get it to the 38 states it needs for ratification. And so we've been talking about not just the history of the ERA, but its prospects for today. Joining us now on the program is Kate Kelly. She's an attorney working with the group Equality Now, working to ratify the ERA. In 2014, we should mention she was excommunicated from the Mormon Church following her efforts to get women ordained to the Mormon priesthood. And she's joining us from NPR in New York. Kate Kelly, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I guess I wanted to begin with the most basic, obvious question. Why isn't there an explicit statement in the U.S. Constitution giving women equal protection?
The United States Constitution was written by men, for men. It was written by men who were property owners, and many of them who were slave owners and slave breeders. And at the time, it was written explicitly to exclude women. You have women at the time actively advocating. You have Abigail Adams, who wrote a letter, and she, it was a very powerful letter. Famously, she said, "Don't forget the ladies." Mm-hmm. And so there were women at the time who explicitly wanted to be included in the Constitution, but that was an intentional move on the part of the Founding Fathers to exclude us.
So for years, it just was left out. But then it comes up in the early 1900s. Tell us who Alice Paul is, because she's important to this story.
Alice Paul is a woman who was very integral and important in the suffrage movement. And so there was Susan B. Anthony, and there were all these other women, Ida B. Wells, and women who were advocating for suffrage. And Alice Paul learned, when she was in the UK, more aggressive and radical tactics. And she came back from the UK and sort of revamped and reimagined the suffrage movement. And it's in large part thanks to her that we have the right to vote in the 19th Amendment. Mm. But immediately after the 19th Amendment was passed, she and others in the movement moved on and said that is step one, and what we need is step two. And now that we can vote and get ourselves into office and into power, we need to integrate women into the Constitution. And so Alice Paul wrote and introduced the Equal Rights Amendment in 1923. It came up in every Congress from 1923 to 1972 when it finally passed.
Wow. So how did the opposition then, from the 20s to the 70s, how did that play out? Was it a major debate going on? What was the conversation like? What was the debate like, as you know?
Well, what's the most interesting thing about the Equal Rights Amendment is actually on the platform of both major political parties for a long time. And so until 1972, it was on the political platform of also the Republican Party.
So to get it passed.
To get it passed. Huh. And so it had this wider support, and it wasn't seen as a partisan issue. It was seen as a wider political issue, and that equality was sort of apolitical, or apartisan at least. And so it wasn't until later that the anti-ERA movement really vamped up. And so it passed in 1972. It had wide political support. You had Lady Bird Johnson and all these other women speaking in favor. And it was ratified very quickly by many states. Within the first year, I believe there were 35 states. And so it really had this big momentum, and it wasn't until the anti-ERA movement kind of startled and gathered together and started organizing against the ERA in the mid-70s that the momentum slowed. So it actually isn't a partisan issue and doesn't have a history of being, you know, belonging to one party.
So when the opposition, the anti-ERA opposition takes off, and we talked a little bit about earlier the Mormon Church's involvement in all of that, but when it takes off, does it become sort of a part of that, you know, moral majority part of the culture war? Does it take on a new dimension, the opposition, based on, like, does it then become more partisan, more, you know, conservative?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, my grandmother was one of the women who received a calling to organize against the ERA in Arizona. So she was the main point person, the PR person, the anti-ERA point person in Arizona, a state which has not ratified. So there were lots of women organizing and they were actually organized by men, as Neil Young pointed out earlier. They were organized by men to advocate and actively organize against the ERA. But they were using a lot of the same culture arguments that were popular in the day. They talked about gay marriage. They talked about women having to participate in the military. They talked about same-gender bathrooms, a lot of these sort of culture war arguments, many of which are now moot, were used against the Equal Rights Amendment.
So I guess the question, you get this all the time, I know, aren't equal rights for women just kind of self-evident at this point? Like, why is it necessary for us to pass an amendment?
Wouldn't that be nice? I think, you know, for many women, the resurgence, I suppose, of the Equal Rights Amendment is coming out of this, you know, 2016 election and a lot of women realizing that the guarantees we thought we had, we actually don't. Mm-hmm. Many things are under attack. Title IX, Title VII, Equal Pay Act, things that we thought were permanent protections are not permanent. And we are not fully protected under the U.S. Constitution. So I think it's been a wake-up call for folks to realize we just simply don't have the basis that we need. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is famous for litigating constitutional cases and taking them to the Supreme Court under the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, yeah.
And under the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, she did win many cases and she won us many, many protections. The problem is the Supreme Court decided that women or gender receive what's called intermediate scrutiny. And there are different levels of scrutiny, and there's strict scrutiny, and there's rational basis. And you don't have to go to law school to know all of these different things. Mm-hmm. What you need to know is that women under the U.S. Constitution receive a lower form of protection, and that just means it's easier to pass and keep sexist laws on the books today, currently. And so what we need is an Equal Rights Amendment, because that will be an anchor in a permanent document that cannot be changed, that will not be subject to the whims of whoever's in Congress or whoever's in the White House, from which we can build a scaffolding to have true equality, permanent equality in this country.
I think in a piece that you wrote, I think you quoted Antonin Scalia back in 2011. Scalia is famously an originalist. Like, he thinks the way that the Constitution was originally drafted, it's not a living document. It was a sort of set in stone. And he said this about the Equal Rights Amendment, or at least about women's rights in the Constitution. He said, certainly the Constitution does not require discrimination on the basis of sex. The only issue is whether it prohibits it. It doesn't. What does that mean that
that means a Supreme Court justice said what is true, which is that women are not protected in the Constitution and not included. Unfortunately, he was right. And so I think, you know, he was speaking with alarming candor when he said that women are not protected, that the Constitution does not prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex. And unfortunately, that is true. And so I think, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg has spoken many times about how if there were to be an amendment added to this Constitution, she would propose and she would support an Equal Rights Amendment. There are many constitutions, I think it's 84% of constitutions worldwide have a gender provision in their constitutions. The United States is by far the outlier, and because we do not protect women.
Do people know this? Most people know this? I know you know this, but do most people know
this? I do.
Yeah.
I think there's a misconception that the Equal Rights Amendment passed in the 1970s and that we do have it, especially with people my age and younger, because we were born after the original fight for the Equal Rights Amendment died in 1982. Yeah. And so if you weren't alive for the time when it was being robustly debated and there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of people marching on Washington in support of the Equal Rights Amendment, if you weren't there for that, it's very difficult to understand that it didn't pass and what the status is now.
So let's talk a little bit about how the ERA comes back. And we need to bring another great character into this story, Pat Spearman, because I think she plays an important role in getting us to this conversation. Explain who she is.
Yeah. So in 2016, in response to the election of the current president, there was a huge surge in the new women's movement, and there was women's marches, and there was all of this momentum. And in a few of the unratified states, there was a turn to focus on the Equal Rights Amendment again. In fact, in Utah, we had the largest march in Utah state history. We had over 10,000 women at the Capitol, and we were all chanting, ho, ho, hey, hey, ratify the ERA. Right. So we had an ERA bill in Utah in 2017 that I wrote and we introduced into the Utah state legislature. But in Nevada, they had the same thing. In Nevada, it got out of committee, and this woman, Pat Spearman, who is a black queer preacher, incredible powerhouse. She shepherded the ERA through and it was ratified. So for the first time since 1982, when the original deadline expired, a new state had ratified. The ERA died in 1982 with leaving three states. They needed three states still. Right. So then we get this additional state, Nevada. Then in 2018, Illinois ratified, which was another unratified state, leaving us with just one state left that needs to ratify. So this incredible woman has essentially resurrected the Equal Rights Amendment in this new era.
So a lot of people figured that Virginia is going to be the 38th. But it looks like it might not. I'm not sure if it's dead in Virginia yet, that effort. But I wanted to ask you about what the campaign has been like in Virginia. What was the nature of the opposition? You mentioned some of those tropes from the moral majority, the idea of that it would somehow overturn abortion restrictions if you did something like this, or that it would make it difficult to separate sexes in some facilities. Was that what was going on in the fight in Virginia against it?
Yeah, and so the ERA fight in Virginia is very robust and still going on. It has passed five times in the Virginia Senate, but it has not been voted on by the House of Delegates. The House of Delegates is currently controlled by a one-person majority Republican. And they did not permit the Equal Rights Amendment to go for a debate, even though there are huge marches and lots of movement. And so it's really exciting. The sponsor of the Equal Rights Amendment bill in Virginia in the Senate is actually a Republican man. And so there's a lot of bipartisan support there, and that's why it passed in the Senate. And so it's really exciting. A lot of the same arguments are brought or trying to be resurrected, but so many are moot. We have gay marriage. Yeah. Women are already fighting in combat roles in the military. Mm-hmm. You know, women are in every type of career. Women are participating at all different levels. And so a lot of these arguments are now that were, you know, very robust in the 1970s are now completely moot and pointless to talk about. And so, yeah, there's a lot of opposition organizing around the abortion issue and talking about whether or not the equal rights will touch abortion. And clearly, I don't think that's a very legitimate argument because there are 26 states that have state ERAs, including Utah. And in none of those states is this, you know, boogeyman argument about abortion on demand real. And so I think a lot of these arguments have now died, and they're trying to hold on to the one last argument, culture war argument, they think is salient, but it's not a valid point.
So we should point out that five states have rescinded their past votes for the ERA, and I'm wondering if that worries you and if you're feeling like we should just start over or we'll have to just start over from scratch.
So five states attempted to rescind. I will point out, I'm going to be a lawyer here.
Okay.
So five states attempted to rescind. There's a pretty good argument that rescissions are not possible because Article 5 of the Constitution mentions nothing about deadlines, and it also doesn't mention anything about rescissions. For three other amendments, states have attempted to rescind, including the 14th Amendment. Two states attempted to rescind, but those rescissions were not counted, and they were listed in the ratified states. And as we all know, the 14th Amendment is now part of the U.S. Constitution. So I think there's a pretty good argument that you cannot rescind a ratification once it's been done. That will have to be litigated at some point. In fact, Idaho was the state that tried to take a rescission case to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court dismissed that case because the deadline expired in 1982. And so I think the rescissions argument is one of the weakest arguments against the Equal Rights Amendment. I think the deadline issue is another issue that comes up. Some folks say, well, the deadline expired in 1982, and so we would have to start over again. But again, Article 5 of the Constitution does not mention a deadline. All it says is that it's up to Congress. And so if Congress put in a deadline, the argument, and then extended the deadline. So the original deadline was 1979. In 1978, before the deadline expired, Congress extended the deadline because of hundreds of thousands of people marching in Washington to extend the deadline and in support of the Equal Rights Amendment to 1982. So they put it in, they extended it, and the argument is today, currently, that they can just remove the deadline. So there is a bill currently in Congress. Representative Jackie Speier from California has a bill to remove the deadline. There's a bipartisan bill in the Senate. Senator Cardin from Maryland has a deadline elimination bill. And then there are also two bills to do a start-over approach. The start-over approach would be to pass, of course, an entirely new Equal Rights Amendment and then ratify it in all the states. The easier and more expeditious route is clearly just to have the one additional state ratify and then eliminate the deadline. Yeah. So the three-state solution is what that's called. And I think, you know, constitutionally, it's very clear that there's a strong argument that the three-state solution will work and that Utah potentially could be that last state.
Okay, let me read the Equal Rights Amendment. Here it is. It's pretty simple. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Now, you've pointed out it doesn't contain the word women in there, which you say means that there could be something broader here, that there could be a way of taking into account, as you've said, marginalized genders and other sexual minorities into this amendment.
Of course. I think this all goes back to the robustness of the language that Alice Paul wrote in 1923 has actually carried through to the modern day, and I think is stronger than including the word women. I think because it says on the basis of sex, it can be argued to include people of all marginalized genders. That includes trans people, that includes non-binary people, and also I think people who are discriminated against on the basis of sexual orientation. Now, I think the really important thing to remember is that that's with the original language. So if we were to start over, it would be different language. I think we've got a really good case for that this can protect people who have been discriminated against on the basis of sex. And that's one of its strongest points. Mm. And I like to argue that that's one of its stronger points.
Yeah. Kate Kelly is with us, an attorney working with the group Equality Now to ratify the ERA. Joining us here in the studio is Sarah Vrains. She's an activist, a midwife, and a Mormon. She's also co-director of Mormons for ERA, and welcome to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
How'd you get involved in this?
Kate asked me, actually, directly about a year ago, and I'd been, the ERA, Mormons for ERA was resurrected in 2015. Kate was part of that.
Wait, from the old days?
Yeah, so 1978 originally, yep, with Sonia Johnson, who we know about so
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
And then it was resurrected.
We're going to do a whole show about her, by the way.
Oh, you should do several shows about
true,
her.
It's true, yeah.
Several.
Yeah.
And then 2015 it was resurrected, and then Kate brought me in just last year.
So how do you explain what is going on? Just update us quickly about the efforts going on in Utah. You're trying to get a bill in the legislature, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Our efforts are labored. It is difficult here. We have a lot going on, a lot of layers with the church and with people being afraid, I think still thinking of the antiquated things the church put out in the 1970s. People are afraid to show their support for the Equal Rights Amendment, thinking they will be not a good member. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the Mormons for ERA, even having that title, we include all sorts of Mormons, but we include the really conservative and the not so conservative, the Democrats, the Republicans, the stay-at-home moms, the men and the women. And we, with that, we want to get something. We want to ratify the ERA, and we want to use Mormons for ERA as this way to get attention from perhaps our more conservative legislators on the Hill.
But there's this impression that the LDS Church is still opposed to it, which we should say, we can't really say that that's the case. It's confusing, I think. We reached out to the LDS Church, and they've said that there's no new statement. There's no nothing new to add. They have sort of this policy of political neutrality, but they're not saying anything, like, at least not much officially.
They're neutral. Neutral is good for now.
You'll take neutral?
I will take neutral. If there's any hint of them not being neutral, then we will have something else to deal with.
But why
with.
Do you figure they're not just opposed again? What's changed?
I want to say that they learned from Prop 8 not to be involved, get more involved than maybe they intend to. And hopefully they will back off and stay neutral. That's great. And let people, you know, members do whatever they want to do to ratify on either or not ratify on either end. But as long as they keep staying neutral, I will sleep better at night.
Kate Kelly, what do you make of that question? Where the church seems to be on this question?
I think it's an excellent opportunity for Utah to kind of revamp what it had in the early days with the church, which is these firsts. You know, Utah had the first female senator ever in the United States of America. Utah had the first woman voting, Sarah Young, who was Brigham Young's granddaughter. Utah had, it's just this incredible legacy of strong, powerful, amazing women participating in government, being leaders, and leading this incredible fight. You know, Mormon women were very, very involved in the fight for suffrage nationwide because Utah was the first state where women voted. And so I think it's this opportunity to really reclaim, to repent for past, opposition to women's rights in general, and to really reclaim our place in the history of the United States, and particularly in women's history. So I think this is a good opportunity. And like Sarah said, if the church stays neutral, that's what churches should be. You know, churches should encourage members to follow their own conscience. And so I see that as an incredibly positive step. I know that the church headquarters told an Arizona legislator last year in their fight for the ERA that they were now neutral. And so that's kind of a positive indication of where this is going. And again, it's an incredibly welcomed.
What are lawmakers saying to you, Sarah?
Nothing publicly.
And nothing you can say then,
yes,
right?
So I can't.
But do you feel, let's see if I can dry you out a bit without saying, do you feel optimistic from what you're hearing?
I do.
Or like, oh no.
I feel hopeful. Okay. I feel hopeful. And what we want to do, and we're working with, we formed this summer ERA Coalition Utah. So all these different groups that have the ERA on as their top priority, we're all gathered together and hopefully just not to keep reinventing the wheel. And what we're trying to do is get whatever name we need to use to get an audience with certain people. We want to have a, hopefully, fingers crossed, bipartisan support to get this on the floor and have everything ready to go before January and have everything in place so we can't be pushed to the side again and again like we have been.
What are Mormon women telling you?
A lot of Mormon women are surprised that this, they remember it as a thing from the 70s, and they thought, oh, I thought that was...
Yeah, that's what Kate was just saying.
Yeah. Like, that's already a thing, right? And then there are some, people I'm related to that are still afraid. So the church used some of those fear tactics in the 70s, and they're still thinking that those apply today. And
that somehow your support for this would be somehow jeopardizing the eternal role of a woman.
Yeah, and being anti-Mormon or against the gospel, when really we want equality. That's what we're told that we're taught, that we have these in the home. They talk about men and women. They're leading the home together. So okay, let's have that then be in the federal arena.
I wonder what you're expecting then in the way of opposition. It sounds like you're just your fingers crossed for neutrality.
Well,
but I guess I'm wanting to know what has changed within Mormonism that makes you think they may look the other way on this subject. I know that they're wanting to cater to younger Latter-day Saints, maybe more progressive thinking women who might be alienated by a church's opposition to that. Do you figure that could be part of it? Hard to say.
It is hard to say, but we do have, there is some other opposition that could be, if the church breathes any sort of negativity. There's, Gail Rizicki of the Utah Eagle Forum. She was really good friends with Phyllis Schlafly, who was, started the anti-ERA movement in the 70s. She lives here in Utah. She's president of the Utah Eagle Forum. And if she gets any sort of, breath of negativity from the church, she would definitely, she can mobilize.
She's still opposed to it.
Well, she was called in Deseret News one of the most powerful people in Utah politics to never hold elective office. So she has a lot of power, and we want to keep her at bay and have her just let us do our thing and ratify the ERA.
So I guess I wanted to ask you both just finally, there would be a kind of poetic justice if Utah became the 38th state. Are you, I guess that isn't lost on you, Sarah Vrance?
No, that's what I've been saying for the last couple of years, the poetic justice of, because Utah was, and the church really helped to stop their ratification. And so it would be such a beautiful thing. And Utah could be in history books for something very good if this happened. It's a race to ratification between us and Virginia right now. It's possible. I'm hopeful. And I would love to have Utah be that 38th state.
K, Kate, we're about out of time. Say something quick, finally, about that.
Yeah, I'm just so thrilled that Utah women are uniting and that we're coming together on this. There's going to be an event on September 27th at The Wave, which is a women's space downtown Salt Lake. So if anyone's interested, they should join us, whether they're Mormon or not Mormon, just to hear about it and just to understand that there, like Alice Paul said, there is nothing extraordinary about ordinary equality.
Kate Kelly. She is working with Equality Now to ratify the ERA. She joined us from NPR in New York. Kate, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Sarah Vrains, she is director of Mormons for ERA. She joined us here in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.